Hi guys, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host Kevin, and if you tuned into a previous podcast, I did one with a guy I work with at the Marine Corps called Cody Carroll. Cody was an enlisted Marine for a little while, then he became a Marine Corps officer, then he became enlisted in the Army, went back to being a Marine officer, spent 9 years in Force Recon as a platoon leader, then a couple of years in the regular Marine Corps as a platoon leader. So he's got tons and tons of, I don't want to say junior leadership, but it's not at that kind of higher echelon where he loses touch with day-to-day operations and managing Marines or so, you know, guys on the ground. So a lot of times in our career, we keep moving up, and the higher you go, the further away from actual hands-on management of personnel. So I thought it'd be a good idea to have a podcast about leadership with Cody, and he's going to throw out some good lessons learned, because we all make mistakes as we go through. So Cody, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin. Happy to be here.
All right. So let's do me a favor. Give a real quick recap on your basically your leadership background, and then let's get into it.
All right. Quick recap. Started off as an enlisted Marine and did the MESEP program, which was the Marine Enlisted Commissioning Education Program. From that, I was able to earn my commission. I was an infantry officer. I did 2 Iraq deployments as an infantry officer, both in a regular infantry platoon and a motorized platoon. I also had a sniper platoon. And then, in a weird career change, I resigned and I enlisted in the Army. I was a staff NCO in the Army. And then I was reappointed back into the Marine Corps, day one lieutenant again. And I spent 9 years in a force company.
I bet it was pretty easy to go back to being a platoon leader after all that, was it?
I wouldn't say it was easy, but I felt a lot more comfortable going into it because I had so much experience at that point where I knew that, you know, the military is like this up or out kind of program where, you know, they expect you to keep progressing. And if you don't, they push you out. So I was very fortunate in the fact that I was able to essentially like reset the clock, both as an NCO and as an officer. So I was able to go back and take into account some of the mistakes that I had made with my first infantry platoons as a platoon commander and just get those out of the way and just move forward as a recon platoon commander.
It's funny because being a leader in a special operations unit, it's a double-edged sword, right? You've got really professional guys. You've got really disciplined guys and trained guys, but you've also got A-type personality that'll call you on your bullshit in a heartbeat, man, and they have high expectations of leadership. So it's a double-edged sword, but they will keep you sharp, man. That's for sure.
Yeah, that is definitely true. And there's so many things that I'd like to share with you about that and that experience, but I think you really nailed it there. And when you're, as a young leader, when you're going into a special operations unit, it might be easy to be the best as an infantry guy, the fastest run times, the strongest dude, the smartest guy, or whatever your strengths are. But when you go to a special operations unit, you're not going to be any of that. And you will be judged on your ability to lead. And that's the bottom line.
All right. So let's go down. You've made some notes here. Let's go down. Like I think it's about what you wrote up initially was kind of your initial counseling when you got new guys into Force Recon, right? And this is important for any business, right? You can't hold people accountable to a standard if you never put the standard out. You got to be real clear and concise on what you expect from them and on what they can expect from you.
Yeah, you're right, Kevin. So I guess kind of to kick this thing off with, when we talk about initial counselings, it is critical that when you take over a team as a leader, that you lay the expectation down like up front of what you expect these men to do or women. So the way that I would do this is I came up with a list, and this wasn't something that I had out of the gate. I did not have this initial counseling format set up when I was first a platoon commander. This is something that, you know, a lot of these I've like stolen from other people, you know, so I was like, yeah, that would work good with my program, or this would work good with, you know, whatever, you know, program that I'm working on. But I think like right up front, you have to decide what your leadership style is. And there's a lot of guys out there that don't have really good role models, or they're inexperienced. You know, like a lot of times you see junior NCOs trying to mimic their drill instructors or drill sergeants, like yelling and pushing people around, well, all of that stuff just falls apart, you know, once the bullets start flying. So I think it's really important to, you know, find a leadership style that's true to yourself. For me, I've always been kind of a laid back dude. You know, I was like a skater kid, you know, and I never really wanted that overbearing, aggressive leadership style. It's more of kind of like, hey, here's the expectations. You either meet it or you don't. And if you don't, then you don't belong here. So I would say out of the gate, that's pretty important. The next thing that I'd like to talk about would be the difference between culture and branding. So everybody knows, you know, like what the Special Forces brand is or what the Force Recon brand is. You know, they see what the quality of product is, you know, the missions that those guys have accomplished. And it's really like no secret. But culture is what is happening on the inside of that organization or that unit. And I think where you have problems is when your culture does not match your brand. And so towards the end of my time as a Force Recon platoon commander, the culture that I wanted to create within that platoon was a family type culture. Like, we are brothers, we depend on each other, and we will look out for each other. And I think if you can really hammer that point home of lining your culture up with your brand, you'll see that not only in business, but in the military, those are the best units and those are the best companies.
Real quick. It's kind of obvious when you've been doing it for a long time, but for me, like, my leadership style changed over the years, right? I was that yelling and screaming NCO at some point, because that's what you think a leader does, right? A junior leader's got to do that in some at some stage, but then, you know, the more you get promoted, the more you get experience, you don't have to do that anymore. How does a young leader who's like a cadet right now, or he's in a military academy, how did they figure out what their leadership style is? It's obviously kind of very tied very closely to their personality, right? So, I mean, and not all, like you said, you know, I stole some stuff. It's a cut and paste world, right? I've done that all the time. But taking something that somebody else wrote and following it blindly is not going to work. You have to, it has to be yours. You have to make it yours. But how does a young leader figure out what is the best leadership style for them tied to their personality?
I think the simple answer to that, it would be just having a feel for what's right. If it feels awkward to you, if you're in a position where it's like, hey, I'm not going to be able to keep up this pace of yelling and screaming continuously throughout a deployment, throughout a firefight, then it's the wrong style for you. If it feels like you're moving at a comfortable pace and the cadence feels right, and it feels natural, then that's probably what your leadership style would be.
Yeah, I'd agree. So it's basically longevity, right? You have to fall into a natural groove, and not all leadership styles suit people, right? So if you're faking it, you're not going to be able to maintain that, right? Do you find, like, when you're in Force Recon, do you find that people come in to your platoon with an expectation of culture, right? Because they strove to get to that unit. And when they got there, they almost fall into a role. Like, this is what we do, you know? And it may not have fitted the personality of your platoon.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we only get one day to screen people. And then after that, they go into a training status. So I think, yes, they do. They have certain expectation of what this leadership style or what the culture of the unit will be. But as you know, as well as I do, like, you know, the culture from platoon to platoon or team to team can be quite different. But the expectation or the brand, I think, will remain pretty constant. So, yeah, it's a complicated scenario. There's no, like, cut and paste solution. Yeah, you can, you know, you can steal and borrow things from other people, but really it's finding all the stuff that meshes together for that correct style that you might be looking for. So yeah, we'll kind of get into this initial counseling. So this initial counseling, I called it the program. And the way that you intake people into a platoon, it's very important that you sit down with them, you go over what your expectations are. And the way that I would do it is I would, hey, here's my expectations of you. So we would cover these 20 things, and then I would talk about what they could expect from me as a leader. And then at the end of it, I would also give them a copy of what the Marine Corps says their job is, all of the tasks and proficiencies that they have to maintain. So there was never any question of what this dude had to do. So the first thing on here, and again, there's 20 things on here, and I'll try to move through them as quickly as possible. Maybe we can kind of just go back and forth and talk about this on each one of them. The first thing that I always tell them is, like, you get to decide how good you are at this job, but the team will get to decide if it's good enough. And I think that's an important thing to grasp as a young man coming into a special operations unit, because you really do. You really get to decide how good you're going to be at this job. You can put as much effort into it as you want, but just know that that team has an expectation of your performance, and if it's not good enough, they're going to send you packing, and I'm always going to support that.
Yeah, if you're not physically capable of doing it, that's one thing. However, not everybody gels with every team, right? I didn't gel with my first team. They had different outlook on things, right? So if you're sent to a team with a certain personality, then you need to figure out if you're a good fit there too, right? But does the team get to decide whether or not they want to keep this guy? Is he on probation for a little while in Force Recon?
Our makeup is typically three teams, three six-man teams, and then one headquarters team per platoon. So yeah, you know, there's just like you guys in SF have 12-man ODAs and you report to a company. We have three teams within the platoon. They're smaller. And some of those teams, yeah, their personality might be a little overbearing. They might not mesh well with one team. But if a team leader comes to me and says, hey, this guy's not mixing well with my team, I can definitely put him on another team within the platoon. Now, that's up to a certain extent. If the guy has flawed character, he's not going anywhere at that point. He'll probably get moved to the boat locker. And I've had that in several occasions where, yeah, this guy might not be meshing well with this platoon. He's not performing, or the team, he's not performing to standard. And I'll talk to that guy and I say, hey, you know, I'm going to give you some options. I think you're a good dude. I would like you to come work for me in the headquarters team, or you can find another unit. And the reason why I would pull him into the headquarters element is so they could see what right looked like. And I would show them, okay, like, check out this team, watch what they're doing here. They're doing this well, they're not doing this. How would you change it? It's more like a coaching kind of phase. But more times than not, I found guys just flat out reject that offer and they would go find another unit. The thing that I can't look past is massive integrity violations, like bad character, you know, those kind of guys, depending on what the circumstances were, I would say, hey, you're going to come work for me, or you're going to work for the comm chief, recharging batteries until the end of your enlistment. I'm not going to ruin your life and get you kicked out of the Marine Corps for whatever, you know, whether it was like substance abuse or, you know, all these other things. It was just, you know, a choice that I made to put those guys in a situation to protect them a little bit. But yeah, I guess kind of going back to your question, I'm kind of rambling a little bit here. The teams, not everybody will mesh well with one particular team.
When you're initially screening guys, any red flags that you see, like excuses, blaming others, stuff like that, you know what I mean? Certain things just pop and you're like, ooh, I don't know if this is going to work.
Yeah, so there's a couple of red flags, and some of them, you know, I may have not initially keyed into them, but one of them is, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, but guys that are extremely fit and that could breeze through the indoc, I found that some of those guys are either, you know, naturally athletically talented, they've been in an environment that has allowed them to, you know, like have all this extra time to work out. And as you know, like once you get to a team, that's not really the case, all right? It's not about working out. It's about doing a job. So it's weird for me to say that that might be an initial red flag as like somebody who breezes through the indoc and this is not hard for them at all. That's one of them. And it's not necessarily anything that I would say, hey, I'm not going to select this guy because of it. But I would say that's something to kind of look out for.
The opposite side of that, but kind of the same thing, is a guy, you know, at a certain point, it became mandatory for, if you want to make sergeant major in SF, you had to have a college degree. A guy who gets his college degree while he's a team sergeant, I got to question that, because I had no time. I was bust. I had no spare time. I'm like, how did you do that? Something was given up. You dropped the ball on something in order to get your college degree when you were a team sergeant. To me, that's a red flag. Kind of the same thing, but slightly different.
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's a lot of like super motivated guys out there that can find the time to do things. But I've always questioned that too. I'm like, man, you were able to get a college degree. I never had time to do any of that stuff. You know, I was afforded the opportunity as in the MESAP program to go to college, which I got a degree in PE because I'm a rock. And I knew I was just going back to the grunts anyway. But yeah, there's some things that are like, okay, you got a college degree, that either means you worked really hard or you came from a job where you were kind of put up on a pedestal and given this extra time, but something gave, right? I've always, you know, it seems like especially officers, senior first lieutenants, captains, they're getting their MBAs on the side. And I'm always wondering how you have time to do that when you should be studying on how to be a better company level officer. If you have time to get an MBA, I mean, you should have a whole bunch of other time to do some, you know, pretty epic things for the infantry. So, yeah, I don't mean to say, hey, these guys are not out there working hard to get these degrees or like extreme levels of fitness, but it is something that it makes me question. And I've seen performance issues on teams with guys that are extremely fit and guys that are extremely educated. And in fact, all of my time in Force Recon, I only fired four guys. One of them was a collegiate athlete, and the other one was self-proclaimed smartest man in Force Recon. So both of those dudes had to hit the bricks. As far as other red flags, you know, there's the obvious stuff that we always look for, and that's when we put guys in the pool. Guys start to freak out, and they get what we call the eye of the gerbil, where they're terrified. And they start looking to grab other people and pull them down. And that's one of the things that we look for. Like instantly, that guy's out. You know, if a guy is so scared in the pool on a little 30-minute tread with a little bit of harassment that they're grabbing their teammates or potential teammates and they're pulling them underwater to save themselves, they're out. Guys that grab the side of the pool, those guys are out too. And it's just a self-preservation thing.
That stuff can't be trained out of them?
I think it can be. Not necessarily at that point. It's not something that we're doing the initial screening at that point. And we want guys that have already trained that out of themselves or been through a process through their normal MOS that has pushed that away from them.
Yeah, you don't have time to fix everything, right? I tell you, some of the hardest PT I've ever done in my life was in the pool. The pool is tough. Water is an ass kicker, man. I know in SF now, it's a requirement that you can swim, obviously, right? But if you can't swim, they'll let you go through selection. At least the last time I checked, they'll let you go through selection. And then during the Q course, they will afford you swimming lessons. So by the time you graduate and get your Green Beret, you can swim fairly proficiently, you know. But they have that time to train you. And you guys probably didn't have that time for that stuff.
No, I mean, the level of proficiency that we're looking for as far as swimming goes is not that high. But what we are looking for is confidence in the water. You don't have to be a fast swimmer. You don't have to be the best swimmer. But you have to have confidence in your own abilities. Because a lot of what we do is in the water. It's amphibious reconnaissance. So we spend a lot of time in the water. And the water that we normally spend our time in is dark. It's at night. There's like dead dolphins floating in it. It's like the world's nastiest water. If you're not confident in a clear pool that's 80 degrees, you're probably not going to be confident in water that's pretty nasty. So yeah, you want me to jump into the list here? Okay, so the first thing on this list from the initial counseling, it's like, hey, this is what I expect of you guys. And number one is mission, team, self, in that order every time. I think that's important. And the Marine Corps is big on mission accomplishment first, troop welfare second. It's not always the best for family life or the best for you, but it is the best for the mission. So I've always pushed this, hey, mission, team, self. And I actually stole this from Greg Kelly, retired Sergeant Major from Alpha 219. I listened to him give one of his speeches, and he talked about mission, team, self. And he was actually my partner when I came through MARSOC Advanced Sniper. Great dude. And I just bumped that to the top of my list. Guy's much better with words than I've ever been. And I took that from him, and I think it's great. So the next thing going down the list is number two, you're your brother's keeper. This is a family. You lock shields and horns with your brothers. This is the motto that I stole from the first air wing unit that I was in, HMLA 169. And we used to have it painted on the wall. It said, "We hate each other, but we hate you more." And so that kind of always went with me. It was like, yeah, you know, that unit, everybody was fighting all the time. But you never let anybody, like, come into your house and deface it. It was like, yeah, we can talk crap about each other, but you're not going to talk crap about us, all right? And I think like building that like strong family bond is super important, and that's why it's number two on the list for me. Number three is be a lion. Profession is not for the faint-hearted or weak-willed. I expect you to be tough, do the right thing, be a hunter no matter what. As long as you draw air, I expect shields to be locked and sword swinging, and you can expect the same from me. And I think that's pretty self-explanatory, but I think I kind of wanted to put it out there. It's like, I expect you guys to be really aggressive in everything that you do, and especially training. And I'll get to training here in a minute, but I think guys are so afraid to make mistakes these days, because right now we're in this weird lull of peacetime, and you know, we're deciding, you know, who's going to advance in their careers based on a training exercise. But if you have leadership that understands that, hey, this is training, it's not that big of a deal. So I just expected guys to be really aggressive, not only in training, but also in combat.
Yeah, I came across that a lot in special operations, especially as a leader. Sometimes we're so down on mistakes that we'll crush somebody for making mistakes. You can't figure out where the line is until you cross it, right? And that's actually one of the things they teach you in SEER school. You have to push the limit a little bit to see what's acceptable, right? I remember when I took over as a team sergeant, and we were in the SIF company, we were part of JSOC and all that, and if you hit a house in training and you had a flyer, I mean, you hit the target, but it was off the silhouette, you went to a safety board, you got a counseling statement, you might get kicked out of the unit. Well, when I took over as team sergeant, I was like, nah, that's bullshit, man. You don't know where the line is, right? So we hit a target, guys that have a flyer 2 inches off the side of the head. I'm like, all right, now you know where the line is. Back it down a little bit. And people were shocked by this because it's such a cultural thing that you have to go to the safety board if you do this and this and this. And I'm like, bullshit. Same thing when I took over at sniper school. If you clipped the loophole on a shot to a structure, you were kicked out of the unit or out of the school. And I was like, obviously, it's not a proper window, it's a cardboard silhouette that you can clip. And I'm like, okay, mistakes are how you learn, right? And if you're so afraid to make mistakes, you'll never progress because you're watching your back the whole time. And I remember saying to my guys on my team, and make mistakes leaning forward and not leaning back, and we'll all be better for it.
That's a great line, make mistakes leaning forward. I'm probably going to put that on this list. All right, number four, use your best judgment, but err on the side of risk. I know what I can get away with because I've crossed the line several times, and I was smashed accordingly. Don't do anything stupid, but don't not do anything that could make a difference. And that's kind of going along the lines of what you just said. I think it's really important to get in there and actually make mistakes. I used to, you know, as an infantry platoon commander, I would always volunteer for whatever the platoon problem was to go first. And then I would go back to the other platoon commanders and be like, all right, here's what the company commander is looking for. If you do these things, he's going to, you know, smash your bag, because that's what I just did. So don't do it that way. Try to something like this. And it, you know, yeah, did I pay a little bit of a price on evals for that? Sure. But I think I got the most learning value out of making the most mistakes. I can't emphasize that enough. And as a leader, you should have those dudes' backs. If they're going out there and they're trying really hard, they're pushing the envelope, they're being really aggressive, and they get compromised, or they do something in a training environment that's, like you said, hey, they were pushing too fast, you know, it's some paper flyers. It's not a real safety issue, all right? They just know, now they know what speed that they can move at or how far they can penetrate into a target before they're compromised. It's not a big deal. Training is training. All right, number five, and this kind of goes back to being aggressive, and it's attack. This goes for all things. If there's ever a question about what you think I would do, take the shot. I've got your back. If you fall on your face going 100 miles an hour, I can deal with that. If you're wrist punching your way out of a brawl, we're going to have problems. 100% on every event, max effort. If there's something that comes after that, it's 100% of what you have left. And I think that's really important, like, you know, like even for like a on the indoc, I'll go back to that, you know, to max out the pull-ups on a PFT, it used to be 20 pull-ups. And you know that when a guy gets on the bar and he gets to 20 pull-ups and he drops off the bar, he did not give you max effort. All right. So what I'm looking for from everybody is 100% on every event. And I used to say this before it was part of my leadership mantra here. It was, hey, I'm going to give you 100% on whatever this event is. And if there's an event after that, I'm going to give you 100% of what I got left.
That's funny. That reminds me of a story. When I worked at the NCO Academy, the sergeant major in charge, who became the USASOC sergeant major later on, great guy, Mark Eckert, when he was off, have their own sergeant major academy now, but before they did, they went to the regular army sergeant major academy, and on day one, they did a PT test, and every single person there did the minimum number of push-ups, the minimum number of sit-ups and stood-up, except all the soft guys. They kept pushing and kept sitting up till the 2 minutes were up. And he said you could look up, and it was a big clash, you could look up across the whole thing and see exactly who was soft and who was not. It was a culture in the army, just do the bare minimum, stand up, you know. So that yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, that's a red flag right there.
100% a red flag. Kind of going back to the PT test, some of the first recon mentors that I had, was a guy named Glenn Cederholm, and he took me to the range with him one day, and he was a legendary DET-1 guy. There's a couple other DET-1 guys there. There's a guy named Chad Baker. And if you were of like the 90s Force Recon era, you knew who these dudes were. And these were like giants among men. And I remember at the time, Glenn was describing Staff Sergeant Baker to me as this old 36-year-old staff sergeant, we look back at that, we're like, man, 36, you're in our prime.
I'd kill to be 36.
But I remember he was saying Chad Baker, ran a 550 PFT, and 300 points maxes it out. And I was like, well, what's a 550 PFT? And Glenn was like, well, you don't have to stop at, the maximum points. It's still the same scale, but it keeps going. And I'd never thought of it that way. I'd always thought of like, well, you just max it out. You get, 300 points, you're good to go. No, it never stops. It's just maximum effort all the time.
550 might be a record. I talked to a young Special Forces candidate one time, and he was frustrated because he finished selection and he didn't get picked up. And he was like, I thought I met all the standard, because you don't know what the standard is. And I found all my points and I this and that and the other. And I said, on Landnav, were you running? And he was like, no, I walked. And I was like, well, there you go. Not giving away standards, but there you go.
Yeah, max effort on everything you do. All right, going into number six, be prepared to operate on commander's intent. I will often tell you what I want done, but not how I want it done. Understand the task, purpose, and the end state. And commander's intent is a hard concept for civilian organizations to grasp. But if I could kind of like explain it from an infantry standpoint. So if I'm an infantry company commander or platoon commander and I task a machine gun section, I tell them I want them to take the top of this hill so they could support us with machine gun fire while we hit another objective. Well, if that machine gun team leader gets up there and he's socked in with clouds or fog and he can't see the objective, was the mission to actually take the top of that hill? No, it wasn't. It was to get up there to support the main effort going in to attack a different target. So it's up to him, operating on commander's intent alone, to understand what that task, purpose, and end state is and get that machine gun team into a position where he can actually support the main effort. So I've, hated being micromanaged throughout my career, because there's always those guys that will like get down into the weeds on you and it just drives you nuts. And if you give me commander's intent, like, hey, I want this done. Got it, sir. I'm going to get it done. I'm going to brief you on how I'm going to do it, but I don't expect you to get into the weeds on how I'm going to run the show to do the job for you. And I've passed that on to my dudes. And I will say that sometimes that can be really frustrating for them, because when they fall on their face or they don't do it correctly, they're like, well, you didn't give me enough guidance. And it's all part of learning. In a situation where, there are lives at stake, I would definitely give more guidance. But I don't know the best way to do everything. And that's why you're in charge of that team. And I think it's really important to operate on commander's intent.
Yeah, commander's intent is a broad-based outline of what success looks like, right? And you decide how you get that done. I think it's a very common error with young leaders to micromanage people. And you look, it kind of depends on your audience too, right? If you have very junior people, you're going to have to give them a lot of guidance. You got fairly experienced people, then you should be able to give them a broad statement and let them run at it, right? Yeah, I've seen that a lot, actually, and you probably have too, especially young officers come in and they try to micromanage stuff. And it's just, and that applies to your civilian organization, right? Give good guidance, step back, check on stuff, and then give good feedback at the end, and then give a little more leniency each time somebody, if I have to do your job for you, I don't need you. I might as well just do it myself, right? So broad guidance, check on progress, and then give good feedback when the mission's done, and you'll have a smoother organization. You're also training those subordinates to run on their own, which is extremely important.
It is definitely extremely important. Number 7, false motivation and bravado are for amateurs. Motivation ends when it starts raining, it gets cold, or the first time you get shot. Discipline and faith will carry you every time. Do things right and have faith in the team. I know you've seen this. You know, you have the NCOs that are like out there and they're, you know, doing the rah-rah thing, and all that stuff just goes out the window, man. Like 3 days into a field op when you haven't had any food, there's no water. It's like, hey, Moody, where's all that motivation now?
That actually motivates me. When I see everybody else collapsing, it actually motivates. I bet you're the same. You're laughing. I bet you're the same. It actually motivates me, and it makes me feel better to see people collapsing around me. Yeah, look, the special operations community especially, they're not really interested in what you can do on your best day. They're interested in what you can do on your worst day. And cold and rain, hunger and sleep deprivation are a serious psychological effects on you. Unless you can push it to one side and drive on with the mission, then you really don't need to be there. But it was like that in basic training. It was all tough guy slogans and yelling and screaming and this and that. And I hated it. I hated it. And sometimes I refused to take part, and I did a lot of push-ups, but I hated that. And they used to actually say, false motivation is better than no motivation. And it's not. But I understand what they're doing in basic. They're trying to build you up, you know. But I wasn't a kid, so I was like, this is so stupid.
False motivation is better than no motivation. Yeah, it just doesn't fly. And it kind of goes back to, you know, your leadership style. And things are going to get tough. And if it's fake, it's gonna show. It's going to rear its ugly head. And it's going to rear its head at the wrong time. All right, number 8, be fit spiritually, physically, and mentally. I don't care if you can run an 8, I'm going to leave out the colorful language I put in here, but 18-minute 3-mile in your short shorts. I do care if you can move out with a 70-pound ruck on, whether it's from 2K offshore or uneven mountainous terrain, perform like a recon marine. Listen to what you said on the on your caffeine and... What do you call that?
Caffeine and questions?
Yeah, caffeine and questions. You know, you talked about the, you know, like the dudes who are like Jack and Steel all the time. You know, we get a lot of that in the recon community. Guys are super fit. But where the rubber meets the road is underneath the rucksack and in the ocean. You know, can you swim with all that gear? Can you get to your target? Can you get to your objective? I think that's critically important, is like hammering down on the cardiovascular side of the fitness realm. It is important to be strong, because we do have a DA mission as well, like kick in doors and do that piece, you know, climbing ladders onto ships. But I think the hallmark of a recon marine is his endurance.
Do you guys wear those UDT shorts?
You know we do, baby.
Unintentional dangling testicle shorts. That's what they're called.
Hey, I look great in those shorts, buddy. I still fit in mine. You know, the old recon guys, when they do reunions, is they always like get their old UDT shorts out. You know, they're all fat, you know, like trying to squeeze into these little shorts. For those of you that don't know what UDT shorts are, it stands for Underwater Demolition Team. And it's a cotton, like 1930s designed men's swimming suit. Yeah, Heartbreak Ridge. Watch that. But you know, initially, like in the original UDT teams, Marines, recon Marines were part of that. But yeah, those shorts are, they've got like maybe a half inch inseam on them. And you might have, you know, some unintended, you know, consequences if you're very well endowed wearing those shorts. I personally don't have that problem. Maybe you do. All right. Let's see here. Number 9, shoot like a professional. At a minimum, you should own 2 firearms and train with them regularly. A rifle, preferably an AR, and a pistol that you can afford to feed. Basic marksmanship goes a long way. You're accountable for every bullet that leaves your barrel. Put them in the right places. I do think it's important, you know, like there is never enough training time in the military, no matter what what unit you're in. And you have to, going back to the beginning, you have to decide on how good you want to be at this job. And if you want to be good, you're going to have to put the extra reps in. Okay, number 10, be articulate. If your reports sound like an idiot writes them, then we will be viewed as idiots. Clear, concise, and to the point, communicate effectively. As you can imagine, reconnaissance is all about reporting. So, you know, we say, hey, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And if you can't take a picture, that means you've got to write 1,000 words to describe whatever it is that you're trying to the commander. So the guys hated this, all right? But when they would send reports up, after the mission was over, I would make them go back through and correct all the grammatical errors. I would make them edit everything. Because if I receive those reports from what we call the ROC, the Reconnaissance Operations Center, I can't just send that up to the next level. I have to go through and have to correct all those grammatical errors. And I understand when you're out there on target doing reconnaissance, you know, you might have done an epic movement to get there. You might have had to do, you know, a long range swim, you know, and before that there was a halo jump or whatever to get to that point. And you're exhausted. But I've been in those situations before myself. I would never ask anybody to do something that I wouldn't do. But I just expect really good reporting from these guys. And that's why I put this in there, is to be articulate.
Yeah, I think you're setting an image of your unit for professionalism, right? And I know, like, we're at this Marine Special Operations Sniper Course, and I know you help those guys with mission planning and stuff. And it's super impressive. These guys are briefing at a very high level. But you got spelling mistakes in there and grammatical errors. People just immediately think you're jacked up, right? And they don't trust things you say. Yeah, I mean, as administrative as it seems, it's actually very, very important. It's a snapshot of your professionalism.
I always tell people that the Marine Corps in particular, and this might be the same for all of the military, it's a pretty negative culture. Nobody looks for what you do right. They look for what you do wrong. And then something as simple as a grammatical error can put an impression in someone's mind of the professionalism of your unit. That's an easy fix. So yeah, let's do it right. All right, number 11, know how to fight and when to fight. This covers a lot. Think big to small. Call for fire and airstrikes, heavy weapons, small arms, weapons of opportunity, hands and feet, grappling. And finally, if all that was taken away from you in captivity, I expect you to be mentally hard enough to continue the fight with your mind. And that's a kind of big concept, but I'm not looking for just a guy who knows how to shoot sniper rifles or M4s. I'm looking for a guy that can fully understand the use of combined arms, all right? Because this is a small team, a 6-man team that's going out way beyond, you know, the envelope of support that a conventional unit can provide. So they need to be able to integrate all of these assets, the call for fire piece, the CAS piece, that's close air support, you know, like calling an aircraft for support for troops on the ground. And then I expected them, we did a ton of grappling and ground fighting. I think it's good for the mindset. I mean, all the dudes are way better at that than I was, but I wasn't afraid to get in there and roll with them on the mat. And I think that's kind of how you build this full spectrum soldier. You start from the mindset and you work your way out to the farthest cruise missile style weapon that we have in our arsenal.
I think people would be shocked about how many skills a modern special forces special operations operator needs to know. We're here at sniper school with young Marines, right, that'll go straight from here to JTAC, calling close air support, or like breaching, CQB language. Like, it is incredible how many things these guys are good at. Just jumping back there, saying you grappled with guys and all that, I think that's an important point that maybe guys like you would take for granted. And I've talked about this before. When I was in the Irish Army, the culture is very much based on the British Army. So it's a very class culture with officers and NCOs and enlisted. It's a throwback from the British. And when I did that at the time, I said, I don't know if it's still like that. And guys who are in the Irish Army right now said it's still the same. Officers are on a much higher class level, right? So when I went through selection for Special Force in Ireland, when I graduated, there was an officer on my course. And when we went from selection to like the Q course, we called it skills course, I think, but he did not shoot with us. He did not train with us. He was put in charge of the course, even though he just passed selection. And he would not shoot with us unless he could outshoot us, which he never could because he never practiced, right? And the whole reason was that they did not want to lose credibility with the men because they could not run or outshoot or outswim us. But you lose way more credibility if you hide in the shadows and pretend you can do something when you can't. I think it was a completely flawed concept of leadership where you never did anything in front of the enlisted or the NCOs unless you could do it better. And that's not the culture in special operations in America. Like, we all go to the same schools, like my team leader was in the same class as me in Sephardic, right, at one point, so I know exactly what he's capable of. But he's way more capable than if he never went, because he was so afraid to show himself up. That's probably a little bit of a foreign concept to you and to most guys like you who grew up in the Marine Corps or in special operations community.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I don't think an officer, I will say that we have had officers like that, and they didn't last long. You know, zero credibility. You know, if you're not out there doing the war thing, one on whatever level that is, whether it's boxing, grappling, shooting with the guys, you are not going to have any credibility, because it doesn't matter if you pass selection. It doesn't matter where you came from. The only thing that people care about is what you can do right now. And, you know, like, I'm not the best, you know, grappler or jujitsu guy, but I'm definitely not afraid to get in there and learn to get better. I mean, we had guys in the platoon. We had one guy that was a professional boxer. We had another guy that was like a semi-pro MMA guy. And then we had guys that were just really good at brawling. And I can remember one of the guys from the platoon, Big Rod. Big Rod, if you're listening, you probably remember this. But this guy is one of the strongest humans on the planet. Just a complete animal. Super nice guy. But this guy would just throttle me every time we'd get in there and we'd start grappling. But I knew if I could get like 10 rounds with him, then I could even the playing field out, because he was such a strong dude. And then I had the endurance on my side. So once we got that out of the way, after he kicked my ass 10 times, then it became a little bit level. But he actually mentioned one time, he was like, man, that was probably the most exhausted I've ever been. But yeah, you got to get in there and you got to do that kind of stuff with your guys, especially if that's what you expect from them. If you expect them to be good at that stuff, you need to get in there, and you shouldn't be afraid to show that you're learning too. All right, let's see here. Number 12, hone your field craft skills, be creative, spend time in the wilderness, hunt for your food, be an outdoorsman. You know, a big part of being a recon guy is being outside and living by your wits and these field problems. So I think these days, like, kids are growing up a lot more in video games. They're not out there skiing. They're not out there climbing mountains. They don't grow up doing this kind of stuff anymore. So this is just kind of like a probe. Hey, get back outside. Do things outside. I don't care if it's surfing, body surfing, whatever. All of this stuff will apply to being a recon Marine. Don't waste time. Be proactive. We have a limited time to train. Draw IA drills on the board. Practice knots, but do something. Time is our most precious commodity that we have, and it's probably the most common thing that we waste. So using all the time to your advantage is it's critically important, and I think that's what makes good teams. You know, if they're taking it as like, hey, this is going to be a 10-hour workday, you know, we could do 2 hours of PT and then take 2 hours of lunch and then just pretend like we're doing something rather than going down to the armory and drawing our pistols out and doing some dry practice, then that's not the kind of team that I'm looking for. There is always something to do to make yourself better. Okay, number 14. The first casualty will be your plan, so don't get attached to it. Don't fall into the trap of spending countless hours building a fancy plan that looks good on PowerPoint. All know it's BS. Plan something that's executable to accomplish the mission. Leave selling it to hire up to me. This is a trap that guys are falling into probably right now as we speak when they're doing mission planning. They're trying to build like these fancy PowerPoints because they think that's what's going to sell the mission. Well, that's really not their job. That's your job as a platoon commander. It's up to me to sell that mission to hire. The only person that they have to sell that mission to is themselves. You know, like when these guys get up there and brief their team missions, even later today, you know, the common theme will be, like you said, buy into the scenario, right? The more that you believe in the scenario, the better of a product you'll produce. The only people that that team leader has to sell is to their teammates. And that's what will ensure their success.
Yeah, a buddy of mine used to say a plan is a commonly understood basis for change, right? That's one. And I don't know if you know who said plans mean nothing, but planning means everything. You remember who said that? It was Eisenhower. Yeah, yeah. And it's not about the product that gets neatly in a binder at the end of it, right? It's about the process of going through and building primary, alternate, contingency, and emergencies for all kinds of stuff. When I was a small unit instructor, a small unit tactics instructor, guys would do like routes that have a primary and alternate. And then because they're so brainwashed that you have to have a contingency and emergency, they'd throw some BS contingency. And I'd rather you say, look, I don't have a contingency. There's nothing else we can do. Because if you throw some BS up there for your contingency, like you're going to walk and it's 50 miles, I'm going to stop your primary and alternate. And I'm going to make you execute your contingency because you tried to BS me, you know? And you were saying, like, if you buy into the scenario and really think about all the things that could go wrong, and especially for reconnaissance element or sniper element, you're so small and vulnerable, you have to hammer down contingencies really, really well in a very realistic way because you may have to execute them. I think in some ways, and I know, like, on the Q course, it was about checking boxes, right? Going through this planning process, checking boxes. And it was like that in the small unit tactics phase. When I got the Robin Sage, I will say that because we were actually going to infill and do this whole scenario thing, and we got all this road to war and all this backstory and everything, and my team had good officers, we did a really good planning phase, and we war-gamed everything about things going wrong and that. And you should step off that helicopter or whatever infill platform you have, knowing that mission inside and out, and being ready for almost anything because you've hashed it all out before you. Yeah, and it's not about the product; it's about the process.
And kind of tying into that, number 15, SOPs are essential, but they should allow for some flexibility. Write them, refine them, memorize them, and file them away. So an SOP is a standard operating procedure, and it can really cover anything from equipment setup to a contingency plan for, you know, a downed vehicle on insert or infill. My pet peeve with this is when I would, you know, like move to a new platoon, they would say, all right, yeah, our SOP is this. We wear our, you know, canteen pouch on the left side or something like that. And I would say, okay, well, let me see your SOP handbook. And there really wouldn't be one. And if it's not written down, when a new guy checks into the unit, say, hey man, here's our tactical SOP handbook. If I can't open that thing up and like read everything that I need to know about being a functional member of this unit, then we don't really have SOPs. And I think it's really important that we capture what we want our standard operating procedures for certain scenarios to be, because it's going to save everybody a lot of time. But if you're not actually putting the effort to write an SOP handbook for your team, then you really don't have any. And then, you know, kind of digging into that a little bit deeper, they should allow for some flexibility. If an SOP, just because it's written in the SOP handbook, doesn't work or doesn't make sense, it should be striked from there. All right. And a lot of guys are like, nah, this thing's written in stone.
And I'm if it's in a binder, you can't change it.
Yeah. I remember you know, somebody telling me at one point, like, yeah, you know, you can fit 10 mini grenades in a canteen pouch. And I was like, yeah, Gunny, we don't have mini grenades anymore. I think we could take that out of the SOPs. All right. Number 16, training is training. It's not combat, but it's still dangerous. Mistakes are okay as long as you're learning from them. Just don't make the same mistake twice. We live in a world where commanders expect perfection at every event, and I am not one of those commanders. And we talked a little bit about that. Training is training, right? This is the time to make mistakes in training, all right?
Yeah, people get so afraid of making mistakes that they don't train realistically. When I got to Germany as a staff sergeant, and I joined my infantry squad. We were in a live fire training exercise. We come up in vehicles and dismount, and then we maneuver up. We have to knock out bunkers and all stuff. And there was contact on the way. They had pop up targets, and we'd be maneuvering along this lane, and targets would pop up, and my guys would be, they wouldn't fire. They'd be like, "Are those targets in the range fan?" And I was like, what the hell is going on? And then it happened again. They're like, are those targets? They were so afraid. And I chewed them all out afterwards. I said, look, if targets pop up, fucking shoot them. If they're out of the range fan, it's the fault of the person who set up the fucking range. I said, you will shoot anything that pops up. And they were like, all right. But you have to have their back. You have to have their back if you want to, again, make mistakes leaning forward. Don't be unsafe. I think we do a really good job in the special operations community about risk assessments and mitigating risk, but we do extremely dangerous training. I remember somebody got hurt in Sephardic, I think it was, when I was running sniper school, and they're side by side, you know, and the woman who is in charge of all safety in SWIC, which is the Special Warfare Center and school, all the schools and training and all that, she came down and did her investigation. And I remember talking to her and she said, look, we do dangerous stuff. Sometimes people get hurt. Our safety standards and our history is really, really good. But every now and again, people get hurt because we do dangerous training. You have to learn from it and move on. But, you know, you try to avoid it as much as possible.
Right. And that's kind of what your operational risk, you know, management is for. Yeah. You know, take a look at all the things that can go wrong. Figure out where you can mitigate it to a point where it doesn't degrade the training or the operation. And then you implement those measures. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. A lot of guys they get so wrapped around the axle on making training safe that it takes away all the training value to it.
I remember when I was in Fort Hood, Texas, when my first duty station was horrible, you know, and it's so risk averse. We'd do squad movement to contact, and we'd get contact, and it'd be a live fire, and you know, you'd set out a base of fire and you would maneuver around to a flanking element, right? And then you'd shift and lift fire and do that. It's a very basic 7-8 tactic for infantry. They had chem lights laid out exactly where you will put your base of fire. And then they had a row of chem lights that you would follow around with like officers watching everything you do. And you would have a row of chem lights to your flanking position. And there are 15 people control. It was the worst training I've ever seen in my life. And then when I went to Germany, it was so much better. And it was just the culture and the command. The 1st Cav Division in Fort Hood was so risk averse that they would rather destroy training than have an accident, you know? And it was a horrible culture. And again, it was the 90s. We weren't really getting ready for war. And when the global war on terror kicked off, we were not prepared. No unit in the American military was prepared. And a lot of mistakes were made. And that's probably why. Risk-averse training.
Yep. That kind of leads right into the next one. If a gunfight breaks out within 75 meters or less and you seek cover, you're a coward. No, I'm just kidding. That's not that's not one of them. But number 17, inspect what you expect. And this is a basic leadership task. If I expect something, you can guarantee no matter what the failure is, whether it's lost equipment or didn't make, you know, standards on target, whether it's time or accuracy, it is a leadership failure because what was expected was never inspected. And that's a huge one. I remember, so we do these things called PCCs, pre-combat checks and pre-combat inspections before we go out on any mission. And the last platoon that I had, I remember I was like, all right, I'm going to do this once and I'm going to show you how I expect this to be done. And all this is a layout of equipment. So like every member of this patrol would take all the equipment that he expects to take out, and it's all laid out on like a poncho, including their uniform. And I remember walking through the guys, all right, hey, I'm going to pick up this guy's trousers. I'm going to make sure all the belt loops are attached. I'm going to make sure that the crotch isn't blown out. Do the knees look like they're in good condition? A lot of people take uniforms for granted. That's your first layer of defense between you and the elements. You know, so I would look at every piece of equipment that these guys had and make sure it was serviceable. Some of you guys might out there are saying, that's a little overboard. But it's not, right? Because if something happens, if that's cold weather gear, you know, if a Gore-Tex jacket is ripped open and this guy gets frostbite, that's on me because I did not inspect that guy's equipment before we went out. So that's the expectation is mission success. And the way that we get there is by inspection.
Yeah, like checking for, especially with inexperienced guys, like dirty clothing is not going to insulate you as well in the elements and stuff like that. I think sometimes even in special operations, especially in special operations, we blow this off sometimes because we're dealing with professionals and we don't want to be micromanaging them. But at every level, it does no harm. To this day, when I was coming here, I laid out every piece of gear I was taking and I went through it. I do it to this day on every time I leave. I lay everything out. I don't just stuff stuff in a bag. It's been so drilled into my brain at this point, I can't help it.
I do the same thing. It's a good practice to be it, you know, like, and I've got my kids doing it now. And, you know, when we go somewhere, if something was, you know, forgotten, you know, whether it was them or me, it's like, well, I just did do PCCs and PCIs. It's a good habit to be in. So number 18, it's not about you. Pretty short and to the point, but that's what it is. And we can kind of use this in almost any scenario. Like, for instance, if a guy goes to a course and he fails a course, immediately, the kind of people that we work on are always, they're their own worst critic, right? But if that guy is like, you know, I failed this course and I'm going to look like an idiot, that's the wrong mindset to have. What he should be thinking is, I failed this course and I've let my team down. I've let my team down because they needed this capability or the skill set to bring back, you know, make us more capable of doing whatever this next mission would be. So a lot of guys kind of get wrapped up into themselves, and it's just not what I'm looking for. I want guys that are thinking about the team more than they are themselves, and that's kind of what it rolls into. Number 19, not everyone will get to come home. It's the nature of what we do. Remember the fallen. Kind of going back to what you said earlier, this is what we do is very dangerous. So... yeah, I don't know. I can kind of go down like a long rabbit hole about all the guys that, you know, we've lost. But I will say that it's very important that you remember who those men are or who those men were and what they did for the community. I'm big on that. All right, number 20. I think this kind of wraps up the culture of the way I expected guys to act in the platoon. So it's number 20, live life to the fullest. You're going to be old someday. Party as hard as you can get away with. Just remember, no one has made it out of this life alive yet.
You're trying to end on a high note, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, and it's I expected guys to work really hard, but I also expect them to be professional. And I'm at a point in my life now where I don't drink anymore because I can't get away with it. It hurts too much the next day.
All right, Cody. So that's basically what you expect from them. What do they expect from you? I think you have a piece on that too.
Yep. So as a leader, my job is pretty easy. As long as everybody was doing their job and they were their values lined up with the program, these are the four things that I would tell them that I would do for them. All right. Number one was hard, realistic, and meaningful training. All right. I expected them to be pushed. I have a high standard because I cared. And then I wanted them to get used to what right looked like in training. And you could flex from there, all right? So if you do everything right in training, you know, when it comes to combat, you know where that line is and where you can take shortcuts. So that was number one, hard, realistic, and meaningful training. Number two, and these are things that I would give them and that I'm providing for them, is professional development in their MOS. If they wanted a school, I was willing to fight for them as long as it made sense, all right, and as long as that they were on the team and they were with the program. So professional development was number two. Number three, and this is the hard one, and it's a filter between the men and hire, and the filter works both ways. And I wrote on here, I know what it's like to be the fan with the crap all over it, and I'm going to keep the majority of that crap from ever reaching the team, down at the where the individuals are. The filter works both ways. There's business that stays at our level. The COOs that need to know what's going on with platoon business, just like I don't need to go know what's going on with team business. But I also put in here, know that if your performance is affected by your business, I will be all up in your shit. But yeah, I think that's really important. Like, as far as the filter goes, like, there's young leaders that may jump on to the you know, like whatever the teams or the platoon wants. Like they're like, hey, I think we should be able to wear cool guy, you know, shoes in the battalion area. Well, I want you to take this argument up to the battalion commander or the company commander. Well, I'm not going to do that because I only have so much lead in my pocket. Do I want to throw BBs or do I want to throw 50 cal rounds? I want to use those arguments for things that actually matter. And it's not a big deal once you get off the range, put some boots on, look professional when you're walking around the battalion area. It's not a big deal. So you work as that filter between the team and hire. And the last one is good libo. That's what we call in the Marine Corps, liberty. I don't expect you to work like dogs all the time. When the work's done, it's done. Party as hard as you can get away with. All right. And those are the four things that I would provide for the guys. And it was a huge blueprint for success.
The best safety brief tip I ever heard, you know, on the Friday was don't add to the population and don't subtract from the population. So if you're a young, and I target officers too, because NCOs have years to build leadership at different levels, right? You're a corporal, you're a sergeant, you're a staff sergeant, you're a sergeant first class, and you're learning as you go, and you're taking kind of steps. A platoon leader goes to freaking OCS or whatever, an academy, and then he's bang, he's in, and he's in at the in charge, basically. And hopefully you have strong NCOs that will help you out. I never had a problem with junior officers because I always sat down and we kind of discussed roles and success. And we were on the same sheet of music and we were a united front, so people couldn't sit, you know, play mom and dad with, you know what I mean, go to the platoon leader, and then if they got the wrong answer, go to me. Like we were in sync at all times. So I never had a problem with that. And it doesn't have to be adversarial and you don't have to be a dick about it. It's just whatever. Again, it's not about you. It's about the platoon and the success of the platoon or the team or whatever that is. Do you have any last kind of advice for a young platoon leader going in dealing with NCOs?
I would say my biggest piece of advice is to lay out your expectations and form your own opinion about who these NCOs are. I was in a situation early in my career where, you know, as you're going through your initial officer training, it's always, hey, trust your NCOs, trust your NCOs. And I'm not saying that they took advantage of me, but I didn't lay the expectations down up front. So I would say that the biggest piece of advice that I can give young officers going in is to set your expectations on what you want your outcome to be, and then hold them accountable for that. And just remember, you're not there to be their friend. They're not going to be your friend. Leadership is a really lonely job. But that doesn't mean you can't have great working relationships and at some point later in your life become great friends with these guys. I'm you know, my last platoon sergeants I'm really good friends with to this day. But we had a very professional relationship when I was in charge. And I always say, hey, I was just there as a guest of the community. Recon officers come and go. I was very fortunate that they chose to keep me there for as long as they did. But yeah, that would be it.
Yeah, at the end of the day, when shit falls apart, you're the guy that's going to be blamed, right? Heavy is the crown, Cody. Heavy is the crown. All right. Hey, thank you so much, Cody. And I always find leadership a very, very interesting discussion because it brings such a human dynamic to every situation. So not all these things will suit you, your job, your personality, but take what you can from it. And if you have specific questions, I was going to say put them down below, but there's no YouTube on this. It's just audio. So, you know, shoot me an email or something like that and I'll try to get an answer for you. Thanks for listening if you're still there. Until the next time, bye.